Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, my dear Patreons, and to those of you joining us for the half hour special, I am Hugh Hendry. I am the acid capitalist. Explanations in the footnotes. I have been fatty gay since the immense and joyful acid cap summer camp here in St. Bart's. But I'm trying to inch my way back as markets. Here I am in St. Bart's, and we have Typhoon Lee or Hurricane Lee, which is to the north of me, and already there's a bit of a head of steam approaching. I can see the cocoa trees in front of me. They're waving. The next 24 hours could be perilous. Pray for me. And it seems an apt metaphor as we now find ourselves in September, one of those months which seem to be populated with what can be big daily movements in risk assets and not necessarily up. Today's episode, I am super excited because I've got a very, very special guest. For the Patreons, for the Asset Capitalists, I am seeking to raise the bar. I want to speak to risk managers. And we just have to use the word excellence when we are talking about Bob Truay of the Barnegat Fund. And may I just say that Bob is on here because he is a gentleman, a friend, a learned scholar. But may I tell you something that he would never have? He's not that type, right? So let me say it for him. This guy is number one. He is the number one bond manager. There are how many? There are 29, count them people, 29,314 competitors in this fixed income universe. Bonds are big. It's a big, big universe. 29,134. Bob's fund launched January the 2nd, 2001. Where do you think we are? This guy, his team, number one. Number one, and it's been number one, I don't know, for the longest time. A compound returns of 13% with a targeted vol of 8 to 10. When your returns are consistently above the variance, you know, the kind of the disturbances, mostly up, positive disturbances, this positive trend, which the Barnegat Fund has demonstrated for all of these years. When you are returning more than your volatility consistently, me, the asset capitalist, we call that genius. So we are in the company of a genius. So, Bob, genius, welcome to the show.
Thank you for the kind words.
Kind but deserving words. And Bob, obviously, I think of you a great deal. I wrote a memoir, which no one is interested in publishing. And I think maybe at some point I'm just going to put it on Substack. But I recall many a tale, but there is a tale of me being called to have dinner in New York in an Italian restaurant near Hyde Park, that's London, near Central Park in New York. And I was dismissed. My services as the portfolio manager were deemed to be surplus to requirement. And this was early October 2008. And I was up 3% for the year. Now, it'd been a tumultuous year. And I had been everywhere. I'd been up 25%, down 25%, but I could feel the earth moving. I was now positive again. And the client said to me, "We have a client and he's down 30%, but he gets it and you don't." And I said, "This world of mine is so strange." And I stood up and I threw my napkin at them. I was like, "You guys, you know, like, of course you can have your money." And I was very fortunate that they gave me, I don't know, 4 to 6 weeks to organize the redemption, and we had the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, And I had a position in the twos, tens, forward, 2 year forward steepeners. And they suddenly blepped 200 basis points. And I made $200 million for clients, for these undeserving clients. As undeserving of me as they were, I've often asked myself, because they were actually smart. And their complaint, if to complete this story, their complaint was that I had just won counterparty, which was Morgan Stanley. Just I had one ISDA agreement. I had multiple ISDA agreements, but I had one prime broker. And they were very concerned about the environment and the risks. And so they were saying, even if you're right, there's a great risk in terms of your monetization of actually retrieving the gains was their concern. But I've often wondered, where are you the guy? Because at one point, despite my incredible introduction, and your record is beyond reproach, but I want to say 2008 was initially a challenge before, of course, becoming another one of your masterpieces. Can you just say, because were you down 30 during at one point in that year?
Yeah, it was down 37% in 2008. That was a very difficult time for me. It was a very difficult time for the fund. But it's a good point in the sense that 2008 was one of those times where products became more mispriced, obviously, as the world kind of melted down. And that was right up our alley. So, you know, we began, as you mentioned, in 2001, and we'd had a great run for 7 years. Share price went from a dollar up to $2.50. Everything was rolling right along. And we had several investors come to us, I guess, as we kind of always do, but they came to us and say, oh, we'd like to invest more. But by the time we got to 2007, and we had had seven positive years, we hadn't lost any money, we closed the fund because we didn't have as many opportunities in 2007. So then 2008 occurs and we lose 37%. That was a very difficult time. These anomalies that we had, you know, were this mispriced and they become this mispriced. So that means, you know, when we put them on here and they went to this misprice, we suffered a loss. And we, you know, we were down 37% for the year, which was very difficult. Now, the converse of that, so looking backwards, it was brutal. Looking forwards, now we have this mispricing. So yeah, I always try and keep my investors updated of these are the trades we're looking at, these are the trades we do, and this is the reasoning behind them. And so hopefully, you know, you never know if this is true, but hopefully when I show them the price, it's this mispriced and it goes to this, I'm hoping, and there's nothing to say that this is etched in stone, but I'm hoping that they'll look at that and say, oh, now it's more mispriced. I would like to invest more in that fund. And so 2008 was a super difficult time. Losing 37% is brutal. I don't want to, you know, pretend that that was good. It wasn't. It was brutal. But in the end, it turned out great for us because it wiped out the fixed income competition. You know, we began in 2001 after long term went under and wiped out the fixed income competition. That is always good for us or any business. When your competition is wiped out, that works pretty well.
Yeah. And remind me, the how did you finish 2008?
2008 was down 37.
37.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, one of vetting your clients is actually one of the most important functions that you can perform, because when I was listening to it, it sounds unkind, but so you had no risk reduction. You were willing, as many respects, to accept the 37 because you had the certainty of knowledge. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I believe you must have had the certainty of knowledge that if held to the maturity, the expiry of the various instruments you had on the books, that you had the certainty of a return. Is that the case?
Yeah. So I don't want to, you know, losing 37%, I want to be clear that that was awful, but we did have excellent trades. Like one thing, I'll show you one summary. This was 2008 that we're talking about. So I'll show you the tips in the U.S., that's the U.S. inflation bond, got mispriced to treasuries. So let me try and do a share screen here. Hold on 1 second. So just to give you kind of, this is a good example of the kind of things that Barnegat does in both. It's a good example in the good way and in the bad way. So here, this is 2008. So at the time, you could buy 2014 tips that mature in 2014 that paid you a real yield of 3.74%. Let me get my glasses on so I don't screw this up. And you additionally, you receive whatever inflation is in the US. At the same time, we could short a bond with almost identical maturity. This is a treasury, and pay 2.56% on that treasury. The inflation swap. So the only difference between a TIPS and a treasury is the inflation exposure. We could hedge out that inflation exposure and lock in inflation of 1.36%. So on our TIPS, we're taking in 3.74 plus 1.36. So that's about 5.1%. On the very similar maturity treasury, we're paying 2.56%. So net, we have this string of cash flows where we receive about 2.5%. The trade doesn't cost anything on day one because we just repo both bonds. So that's the positive looking forward. Let me give you the negative. So here, down here, you can see the graph of this relationship between TIPS and treasuries. So this is the yield. The black line is the yield of TIPS. Once inflation has been hedged out, the blue line is the yield of treasuries. You can see TIPS historically yield a little bit more than treasuries. People aren't used to them. Any funky bond is going to yield a little bit more than a normal bond. So the TIPS yield more than treasury. You can see here, you know, what's that, 35 basis points more than treasury. We come to 2008. Lehman held a lot of TIPS and they go bankrupt. Everybody knows that they're going to have to liquidate those TIPS. Similarly, what's the safest investment in the world? Treasuries. The whole world buys treasuries. So those yields go down. So here, the blue line, you can see the yield on the blue line plunges as everyone buys treasuries. The yield on the black line are TIPS, which effectively, once you hedge out inflation, are a treasury. Those yields go up. So the difference between the two is this red line. And it goes up from, you know, let's say 50 basis points mispriced at this point to 250 basis points. So just to give you the bad side, we got into this trade when it was about 125 basis points mispriced. It goes to 250 basis points mispriced. We are losing a lot of money. We have a variety of trades on. In general, we hold about 15 to 20 trades, of which this is one. But so 2008, a lot of our trades lost money, including this one. But this is an important idea in the sense of, if we can hold the trade to 2014, we know we're going to receive 5.1% every year and pay 2.5% every year. That's obviously a moneymaker as long as you can hold it to 2014. And so a very important point is, you know, long-term capital, they were right on all those fixed income trades. If they could have held them, they would have done just fine. Barnegat began right after long-term capital went under on the similar thing of just holding those trades. They worked out great. We made a lot of money. So this is the same thing. One of the big things about fixed income relative value and the reason we've been able to outperform is the ability to hold the trade. So one, we had enough excess collateral, but two, you know, you talked about filtering investors, which is very difficult, but so far we've done a pretty good job on that. And the investors stuck with us and added to their money in 2008. And so clearly at this point, we're receiving 2.5% more than we're paying. So we're receiving a little more than 5%. We're paying about 2.5%. And now you'd think, oh, this trade snaps right back. It never happens the way. It took like 3 years for this trade to come back to being efficiently priced. So that's the kind of thing that Barnegat does. We put these trades on. Frequently, we get run over. This is a perfect example. We thought it was a great trade at 125 basis points mispriced, you know, 1.25% each year. It went all the way to 2.5% mispriced each year. We lost a bunch of money, but we were able to hold the trade because we had enough excess collateral. We had intelligent investors who understood what was going on, who stuck with us and added to the positions. And 3 years later, we took the trade off as it became efficiently priced again. Now, one other note is, as the trade is more mispriced, we'll have more of it. As it becomes less mispriced, we'll slowly reduce that trade. So it wasn't a binary situation of everything on at 250 and everything off, you know, when it gets to zero. As it's more mispriced, we'll have more of it. As it's less mispriced, we'll have less of it.
I wanted to say, so we had the demise of LTCM. We had the demise of Lehman Brothers. This year, we've seen the demise of SVB, you know, the Silicon Valley Bank. They weren't doing an arbitrage, but they had an investment which had the certainty of of a prophet or the solution of the present negative mark on their book, which was their holding in US treasuries. And they had an agreement with the US regulatory authorities where that negative mark to market did not have to pass via their income statement. They did not have the vetting or the ability to vet the shareholders, in this case, those who had money on deposit. And so their demise was a function of this extraordinary event, which was the run on their deposit base, where they had to actually crystallize those losses. So there's a vague comparable, if you will, that you know that if their deposits had proven robust and really robust in the model that we had assumed the norm up until the 7th of March. I mean, the run on their deposit base was extraordinary. But I guess their positions were vanilla and therefore wouldn't really come in. You didn't see that. So I guess what I'm suggesting, because I think year to date, you're having another blockbuster year to date. Yeah, I think you're 17 on the year.
Yeah, we've been fortunate. It has worked well this year.
Yeah, I mean, it's as joyful as I am for those spectacular returns, well done, you and team. I'm like, I would kind of prefer it if you were struggling. You know, why are you having such a? You know, because you will have these trades and this arbitrage, and you need time and patience for them to come through, and then. The greatest danger for you is the vicissitudes of cycles and the mispositioning of others. Can I conclude that if you're up 17%, there are no vicissitudes, there are no misplaced bets and vulnerabilities in the financial sector, because that doesn't accord with my understanding of where we are today.
Sure. So one of the things I would say is that, remember, we're doing relative value. So just using that TIPS versus treasury for a moment, that, you know, if TIPS yield and treasury yield, so let's say the TIPS is at 5% and the treasury is 2.5%, let's say they both go, you know, up a percent or down a percent, we're indifferent to that. The level of the yields, we really, it's that mispricing between the two products that we just hold until maturity and clip those coupons. So one of the things I would say that this year, there have been some wacky things, but it's been more yields have shot up, as in, you know, let's say the relationship TIPS versus treasuries is pretty efficiently priced right now, and they've both just gone up a lot in yield. So it's the relative value hasn't taken the beating. It's been more the outright level of yields have changed significantly as the Fed has, you know, gone from zero to above 5%.
But 2021, here we were talking about, you know, well, in fairness, we started with the drum roll of your extraordinary returns that you are number one out of 29,134. But then we did spend a lot of time discussing you losing 37%. And now I want to go to 2021 and you've only lost money two occasions. So again, what was it about 2021 which affected the strategy?
Yeah, so 2021, that was very difficult on me. We lost about 12%. And to me, though, that was almost worse, or it was worse. That was harder on me than 2008. So one thing, you know, my sister says to me, you define yourself by your share price, which is true. That's one of my weaknesses. I live and die by the share price. The thing that happened in 2021 was, I think I made my first significant trading error or incorrect decision. So one of the things that was going on in the UK was that interest rates were way below inflation rates. And I didn't think that could happen over the long term. So just to give you an example, the 30-year inflation rate in the UK was about 2.5% higher than the 30-year interest rate. So I thought, well, that's crazy, because who in the world is going to make that investment in an interest rate 2.5% below the inflation rate? So I thought those yields were way too low. So just let's just say a pension fund kind of has to do that. Their liabilities go up with inflation and their assets are basically the interest rates they receive. pension funds are going to be, if you wait for 30 years at a difference of 2.5%, that pension fund is going to be 50% poorer in 30 years because their liabilities went up with inflation, their assets went up with the yield. And if their yield is much less than inflation, they're going to be much poorer in 30 years. I thought that couldn't happen, and it did.
Are you saying that a pension fund essentially would be accepting the rate of the rate of British inflation minus 2.5% every year?
So if they own a 30-year gilt, let's just to make it simple, a 30-year gilt yielded like 2.5% less than where 30-year inflation traded. And that was a losing trade for us. Now, I was happy with that strategy. And in the end, that one worked out okay. But the one thing, the error I made is that we usually put our trades on well into the future and then we just sit and wait. The inflation swap that we had exposure to the short end actual inflation fixing. And this is a little bit in the weeds, but inflation got up to like 8%. English inflation got up to 8% while the Bank of England had interest rates at zero. I never thought that could happen. And so we owed that 8% on the inflation swaps that we had. And so I would say in my 23 years, that's the one big mistake I've made that was very frustrating. We were down 12% in 2021. And that hurt because I felt that I had made a dumb move. Whereas 2008, I viewed that differently. 2008, I viewed as the world's going crazy. TIPS, you know, should have the same yield as Treasury. It's the same maturity, the same government, the same credit. But the world's going crazy, and now it's this mispriced. I viewed that as more of a problem with the world than me, and I just needed to be patient, and we would make that money. Whereas 2021, I viewed that as I had made an error by having exposure to the very front end of the curve. And the big thing on having exposure to the front end of a curve is that anything can happen, and then it's over. You don't get the chance to make that money back. So as in, Bank of England has rates at zero, UK inflation is 8%. I didn't think that could ever happen. We lose money, and that has happened, and it's over. Whereas if we have those trades out 10 years in the future, we have plenty of time for things to normalize and come back. And I was very upset with myself, and that's Ben Barnegat's biggest error in the 23 years.
So explain to me again, the error that you analytically you'd missed the exposure to the short term, or the error was you hadn't conceived that inflation could pop to 8% in the duration of the swap that you were playing?
Yeah. So the error was the exposure to the short end. I should have had those trades. Let's say, so you can trade a 30-year inflation swap. So you get to receive the interest rate for 30 years and then you pay today's inflation rate. Or you could have, let's say, a 20-year inflation swap that starts in 10 years. So it's well into the future. You have the same, you know, principle of interest rates versus inflation rates, but it's 10 years into the future. You have 10 years for that thing to sort the problem out. I chose to have a swap that went from today to 30 years. The portion of the trade that went absolutely haywire was the stuff today. And that is what hurt. I should not have had that exposure to today's inflation relative to interest rates, because anything can happen there. I didn't think that the Bank of England would ever have rates at zero with inflation at 8%, but they did. And that exposure hurt us. And that was my error. I should have had, instead of going from zero to 30 years, I should have just said, no exposure for the first 10 years. Let's just go from 10 years to 30 years. The interest rate differential is the same. So I'll just put it out there in the future. I have 10 years to wait for this to sort itself out. And just so you know, and you know, I appreciate the nice intro of us, you know, having the excellent returns. That trade, and you know, I mentioned too, buying low and selling high. I try and remind myself of that constantly. That trade was very painful in 2021 because of my exposure to the short end. And we removed half of that trade. And then sure enough, when Truss came in, and you remember she was prime minister for a few months, when she implemented all those things, UK interest rates went haywire, where they went much higher. The trade that I had on made all the money we'd been hoping for, but I had removed 50% of that trade in the pain of 2021. And that's another thing, you know, that even though we've done so well, that I have, you know, that was my big mistake. As in, you got to remember, even at the most difficult times, buy low and sell high. And I bailed out of a trade and I sold low, you know, when our P&L was low on that individual trade in 2021. That was a mistake by me.
Well, you have to extract mistakes from the portfolio. You analyzed it. You saw there was an error, and you had to do something. You had to take an allocation away from the error.
I really try and buy low and sell high, and give myself time for these trades to sort themselves out. So like on the TIPS treasuries, you know, that trade was 2008, they mature 2014. We have 6 years. Even if it doesn't sort themselves out, we just clip the coupon. Whereas on this UK situation, I allowed myself to have exposure to the front end. And then once that front end sets and you have to pay the coupon or receive the coupon, it's over and that money's not coming back. That was the thing that I'm mad at myself about.
But was that a kind of post the event realization, or was that you had erred in the way that you put trades on? Like, you have a way of doing the trade. The trade should have been the kind of 10-year forward. You always do the 10-year forward, but in this case, you hadn't. Is there a reason why you had consciously chosen not to do that, or it was just a misstep?
Well, I didn't think that the central bank would ever have rates at zero if inflation was 8%. I didn't think that was a risk that would ever happen. And, you know, it's a perfect example of anything can happen. And you have to have enough excess collateral. You have to have enough time for your trade to sort itself out, that even if completely nutso things happen like 2008, that you have enough excess collateral, that your investors are stable enough, that you can ride out that pain. You know, that's again, on the example long term, they were right on all those trades, but they couldn't ride it out. That is super important in fixed income relative value. Can you hold the trade?
So, guys, there you have it. That is the 30 minute teaser with the one, the only Bob Truey, the number one fixed income trader in the continent of North America. Now, 30 minutes is complete. What happens next? What happens next is beyond the paywall with the Patreons. We have another 90 minutes. Bob discusses the $100 million trade. His fund is $500 million. That's the NAV. And he has a trade which over the last few years has contributed $100 million of profit. We discuss it in length. I have to say, why should it not just persist? Amazing trade. Would love you to participate to learn more. However, we would need you to visit the Patreon page. We would need you to become members. Anyway, love you all. Hugh Hendry, former macro hedge fund manager, now the asset capitalist. We made such... What have we done to our fair maiden, to quote one and only Jim Morrison? We've abandoned our fair sister. We've ravaged and plundered. And now I got to get high to avoid just looking at the state of affairs that we have. Anyway, take care, folks. September, you know what happens? What can happen in September? I'm just saying, until next week, bye. We'll be right back.